Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. Could the government save hundreds of millions of euro now by re-tendering for the Children's Hospital? We ask what type of protest is acceptable and who gets to set that out. And will the public sector pay agreement be blown up by the deal done with the nurses? That and more, but first the news, read by Ciara Nevrin. Thank you very much indeed, Ciara. I have a very nervous chairperson of Fine Gael before me here because of this talk of retender for the Children's Hospital project, and you could save hundreds of millions of euros. That's what they say. Now, I'm sure Fine Gael backbench TDs are coming to Martin Hayden's door and saying, we need to consider this. But we'll get to that in just a second. Let me introduce our panel fully. It's Martin Hayden, chairman, as I say, of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party and TD for Kildare South. John Curran is a Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin Midwest and spokesperson for Urban Affairs. Ivana Bacic is a Labour Party senator and Reid Professor of Criminal Law at Trinity College Dublin. Antoinette Cunningham is Deputy General Secretary of the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors. And Jennifer Bray is political reporter with the Irish Times. 51551 if you want to get in contact with the programme, Saturday at rte.ie. Let's have a listen to Martin Hayden's colleague, Minister Simon Harris. He spoke with Brendan O'Connor just before this programme and he responded to BAM. And BAM is a company, of course, the contractor who is taking on the project of building the Children's Hospital in Dublin, which has caused so much controversy because people have said there are massive overruns in terms of costs and so on. BAM made the offer to cooperate with a re-tendering process if that's what the board and the government wanted. They made that offer yesterday. Today on that programme, Minister Simon Harris had this to say.
BAM were awarded the contract. BAM say in their statement last night that they're getting on with the job and they remain committed to the contract.
Yeah.
They make a point that if the government or the state, because actually the power doesn't lie with the government, it lies with the hospital board. Yeah. If they wanted to walk away, they'd be happy to have that conversation.
Okay.
I'm happy for the project to continue. My priority
so you're
is building
saying, BAM,
this hospital.
No, we don't want you to walk away.
I want everybody to continue to do what they signed up to do. Build the hospital that's been promised for decades and the kids desperately need.
Does anybody in the panel think that the minister is wrong?
Yeah, I do.
John Curran.
I think in light of the fact that PwC have been appointed to conduct a review of this process, in light of the fact the offer made by BAM, I think it was probably premature to come out and say we'll continue on regardless. I think the offer made by BAM, the whole tendering process and the review being undertaken by PwC should continue and should be done in light and in the knowledge of the offer made by BAM. Now, we don't know the detail of it and it might change nothing, but to sort of, with 6 weeks, I think it's the end of March, the PwC report is due to come out. I would be extending the terms of the reference of the PwC report to look at the offer made by BAM to see if it would have any change, any beneficial change.
Extend by?
Not within the current time frame.
So end of March?
End of March.
Oh, so we extend the terms of reference. Would you agree, Ivana Bacic?
Well,
what's Labour's position?
I'm interested to certainly Labour is of the view that the Minister should certainly take into consideration what BAM have said and the prospect of re-tendering to see if that would be a way of saving money. I'm interested, though, to hear John Curran say that he thinks the Minister is wrong. I wonder, does that mean Fianna Fáil will be supporting the motion of no confidence
in
the Minister this week?
We'll get to that one.
But I think yes, of course, any offer that might lead to a reduction of costs while still delivering the very important project of the Children's Hospital should be considered seriously by the government. I think it may have been somewhat premature to say we'll be proceeding regardless at this point in time. You know, having said that, I think looking at the text of the BAM statement, clearly what it leaves out is what would be the consequence if the government were to take them up on it and to retender. But I think at the very least, the government should be meeting with the board.
Labour and the Fianna Fáil's contention that there are massive savings possible here?
Well, we don't know is the answer. And I think it's what's interesting is if you look at the reports that some of the overspend is not related to BAM's direct costs in any case. But, you know, so there clearly is a lot of questions.
So,
still
so delay, you're saying
Deputy
delay
Alan
the
Kelly,
project.
My colleague Alan Kelly has certainly been seeking to get some sort of clarity on this, which we don't yet have, on exactly what is the nature of the overspend, who was responsible for the lack of oversight, clearly a lack of communication, clearly lots of questions in deeper in the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, in other words, and questions for Minister Pascal Donoghue. As much, if not more, than questions for the Minister for Health.
Well, the likes of Mick Wallace, who has experience in this area, said, look, we could say potentially, I think, 500 million or so. Why not consider the offer, Martin Hayden?
Tell me the construction company that's saying they can do this cheaper. where are they? You know, there's lots of commentary, there's lots of comments out there. Ultimately, this is a decision for the Paediatric Hospital Board, Development Board, but when Cabinet considered this before Christmas, they had three options before them.
Well, originally BAM said they could do it cheaper, isn't that right?
No, but in terms of phase A has come in on target, and obviously the independent examination is key to make sure that we control costs as much as we can as it proceeds. But, like, you know, the only people who will lose out here if this project is halted, is either stopped or paused or retendered, is the sick children of this country into the future. And
what about the taxpayers who are putting up the money for this?
Absolutely.
Will they not lose?
Everything we are doing is to try and ensure that this is delivered as cost effectively as possible.
Why not?
We are frustrated.
We know there are problems, and it is precisely because of the concern of the cost overrun and possible future overruns that PwC have been engaged by the Minister. And what I'm saying specifically is, having made that offer, it should be included in the terms of reference of the PwC, and the Minister should have an open mind on it until the conclusion of that piece of work.
And if
other
he doesn't,
than that, it seems futile engaging
and if he doesn't,
PwC.
John, if the Minister doesn't have an open mind, then what?
Well, the Minister will defer to the Board and say it's their decision, but I'm certainly saying you've engaged PwC. What is the point in engaging PwC when a significant change has occurred this week where BAM have said, now, we don't know the terms in which they'd walk away. That will be part of
that's a crucial point.
And that's part of the reason I'm saying it should be included in PwC's work, to know if they walk away on what terms and what that might be.
And you're saying that delay only to the end of March. Why not? Why not look at it?
Look, Cormac, at the end of the day, when we talk about the figures that are involved, part of the cost that's included in the overall figures for the hospital is 40 million that was spent on a matter site that, you know, back in a previous time. We have had this debate for so long about where the hospital should be, how it should be delivered, and all of those elements. We absolutely want to control costs. We are very frustrated that it is, you know, the original estimate was far short of what it is now costing.
A fairly poor job of controlling costs, and this is why people are saying, look at this text. Why not build apartments on the site for students and young workers at good rent
I'll tell
and
you
profit, and build a hospital at Blanchard Sound? It's not rocket science. People don't trust that you can control costs at all.
Why. Me and my wife had a new baby last May, and we spent 10 very difficult days in Crumlin afterwards. And I tell you, anybody who's experienced our three paediatric hospitals in this country know we need this new hospital. And that is a fact of it. That is why it has to be delivered, and it has to be delivered for the sick children we're going to have in this country for the next 100 years, and it is the right thing to do.
Jennifer Bray, could it be retendered at this stage, I wonder?
That remains to be seen. I think from the very beginning of this project, we have seen very key decisions taken on the basis of time and how quickly can we get this hospital built. The whole decision to go with this two-step process, which is the process that allowed these surprise costs to emerge, was done on the basis that it would basically allow the hospital to be built a year or two earlier. And aside from the fact that if you retender it, it will cost, you know, at least 150 million extra, potentially an extra 2 years or a year and a half, there is another issue beyond the delay in the money, and that is the capacity of the sector itself. For example, last November, the board of the hospital met and they discussed retendering as an option, and they basically said that there will be little or no interest from international players, and that at home there'd be very limited interest because they said there are only two construction companies which actually have the capacity to build a hospital like this, and that even those construction companies that are here, they're more interested in sort of bigger commercial projects, stuff with Intel, for example, was an example that they gave. So I think that there is the issue of money, there is the issue of time, but there is the issue of, is there anybody out there who can actually take this project from where it is now and finish it? And it seems that the board certainly think that there isn't.
Well, there's the issue of lowballing as well. And Simon Harris was asked about this as well. The Taoiseach's comments in the Dáil during the week saying that, look, if he had his way, some companies who tender for projects wouldn't be given state contracts anymore. Let's have a listen to what Simon Harris and the Taoiseach had to say in terms of lowballing and some companies and their quest for state contracts.
The Taoiseach made very clear in his statement last night that he wasn't talking about any particular company, and the record of the Dáil shows that.
And we also particularly want to look at past form of contractors and public service references, because there are one or two contractors who, quite frankly, I would not like to see get a public contract again in this state.
Does the Taoiseach need to clarify what he says, John?
I think he does. Certainly the context he said it in the Dáil, while he didn't name anyone, it was during a very specific debate on a very specific issue. And I think he does need to clarify that comment.
Has he caused any reputational damage, you think?
that wouldn't be for me to say, but certainly I would understand that some of those companies who may be tendering may feel that. So there is an issue there for the Taoiseach to clarify, no question about it.
I think also, the other point about that throwaway and rather silly remark, in fact, in the Dáil, I suppose, is the lack of effectualness of it. Because in reality, procurement processes are governed by EU rules and by legislation. And a comment like that by the Taoiseach, while it sort of contains this kind of implicit threat and while, you know, it may be clear to everyone listening what he's really talking about, nonetheless, it doesn't really have any effect. And I think it's another example of the Taoiseach saying things in this sort of almost flippant fashion that are actually very serious, that may have serious consequences, but in fact have no real effect, no substantive effect. I do think it's a problematic statement. I do think, just following what Martin said, I mean, any of us who spent time in Crumlin with children, and I absolutely agree with you, Martin, in terms of the need for the new hospital, and I think that's inarguable. I think what the problem is arising out of the all of the way in which this cost overrun has been allowed to develop and the way in which it's come to light, I suppose, is that we've seen the government losing a lot of their reputation, the reputation they had, I think, sought to build as the, you know, prudent financial managers, as having a good record of economic governance and so on. I think that's really been damaging to Fine Gael as the key government party, because clearly it's how the overruns were allowed to develop, you know, and how, and the lack of oversight and in particular lack of communication between the departments of public expenditure.
Well, surely Fine Gael backbenchers are spitting fire over this, are they?
Well, but let's be clear here. But the reason this is, you know, if we actually take a bit of context and say that it is the exception than the rule now that we have a large scale capital project in this country overruns.
I don't know about that.
But this is a massive project.
No, this is a massive project. And
others.
We are extremely frustrated by it. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we had Thornton Hall, we had Glass Bottle Side, we had so many different varieties. This was the regular occurrence. It's not the norm anymore. We've delivered the Goree Bypass, the N17. I can list a range of different roads.
For sure, yeah. But what about delivering huge projects like Irish Water, for example? That was a fiasco, wasn't it?
Absolutely wasn't. I tell you, I deal on a daily basis. Irish Water was absolutely the right thing to do in terms of streamlining and bringing together. We had 31, 32 different local authorities, all as many little silos doing their own thing in water services, to bring that together.
But the Irish Water you delivered was not the one you proposed in the first place.
But the principle
And this
of,
goes back to competency as well. People are saying, look, what about the second terminal in Dublin Airport? Only this week was the sod turned on it. The Metro Link deferred.
The runway, you mean?
The Metro Link deferred. So many projects either are deferred, and they'll have to be deferred even more of them now because of the overruns.
But that's
in
not the
case.
Hospital. We have 18 primary care centres that are going to be open this year. We have 90 new schools that are being delivered. You know, Project Ireland 2040 is actively delivering, despite the best efforts of the opposition, to try and scaremonger around the country this week.
You talk about primary care centres, and just let me give you one example, specific example in my own area. A primary care centre that was promised in Rolla in North Clondalkin in 2012 has taken years and years to look for a site, acquire a site, direct provision by the HSE to build. In the summer of last year, it got planning permission. It is now subject to scrutiny in terms of the capital budget from the HSE. Will it qualify or will it not this year? And that is dependent on the overrun of the national...
Yes, it is. Let's dig out every local paper around the country this week. And in every paper is Fianna Fáil saying this local project is gone.
I didn't say it was gone. I'll give you an example of a primary care centre
in Atai that has had many delays, that has started construction now and it will be open for business at the end of November. So for every one example that Fianna Fáil want to come with and tell people the world has ended, we
I
can come up ones that are delivering.
I said it.
Project Ireland
2040.
I said specifically, Martin, it received planning permission in the summer of last year, July 2018, and as of last week, the Minister couldn't confirm if there would be funding available for it to proceed this
because
year.
Because the HSE capital plan will be unveiled in the next couple of weeks and you will have absolute clarity there.
I think what we do need from government is clarity about exactly what projects are being stalled or delayed or permanently put on ice because of the overrun in the Children's Hospital. And again, Alan Kelly and others in the Dáil and indeed in the Shannon, we've been pressing for answers to those questions and we still don't have clarity on that. And I think that's the context we're working in.
It was a foregone conclusion that there was going to be a massive overrun in costs by the decision to build this hospital in an already congested city. Apart from this, the decision was an expression of contempt for the 3.5 million citizens who live outside of Dublin. And there are many texts. They keep mentioning the site, but we'll move on if you don't mind, because this is the last clip I'm going to play from the Simon Harris interview. And we're moving on to a different topic, but I think it goes to the heart of what some of the texts are getting at. Huge condemnation and criticism about the protest, the action outside Minister Simon Harris's home during the week. Many in powerful positions and across the political divide were critical of the protest. This is how Simon Harris spoke about it when asked about it on Brendan O'Connor's programme.
Like, I've been on protests and I've been protested at.
But why was it not a protest?
Because this was not a protest. This was a clear attempt to intimidate my family and my neighbours. These were people, some of whom seemed to have travelled quite a distance, who had come to my home on a Sunday afternoon and effectively blocked me in my home with my wife and with my baby. And I think it was intimidation and thuggery.
Let me go around the panel and start with Ivana Bacic. Very quickly, is it ever okay to protest outside a politician's home?
No, I don't believe it is. I don't think that's a legitimate form of democratic protest. I think there are plenty of other opportunities. We, public representatives in Ireland, TDs and senators, are very accessible.
Not outside
generally.
The home. John
I've
Curran.
Certainly been picketed and physically threatened in
okay,
the past.
Okay, we'll get to that,
but
specifically and briefly,
no,
succinctly, never.
Never. In my view, it is not appropriate because it's not just the politician who's living there, it's their family. And it has an impact on other neighbours. It is inappropriate.
Never. Is it?
Absolutely never. I signed up for life of public service and I take with it all the pros and cons of that. My wife, my family didn't sign up
Did
for
not.
That and they're not a legitimate target in any protest.
And Jennifer, what's your opinion?
No, protest is a constituency clinic. Protest the Dáil or any of his official offices, but not someone's home.
Antoinette Cunningham of the AGSI, what's your opinion on this?
No, I don't believe it's acceptable in any circumstances to protest outside the home of any politician in this country. There are plenty offices and government buildings where protests can take place and this form of protest should be condemned.
See, in a way, you have a role here, don't you, in terms of policing protests? And so what is acceptable in your opinion?
Well, I think it's acceptable. Every citizen has the right to protest, peaceful protest. Unfortunately, it doesn't always turn out like that, but you have to respect the right of citizens to express their opposition to a public policy or an item of the day, as it were. But there is plenty of places, offices and places where protests can happen, and certainly not at people's
homes.
But
isn't this the problem here? Look, some people will listen to the five of you and say, this is Establishment Ireland telling us where to protest and when and to make it nice and comfy so nobody is upset.
No,
isn't that it?
No, if you listen to Simon Harris's interview earlier on, one of the really disturbing aspects was when he basically suggested that his wife and child were followed home as she was out for a walk with her 3-week-old baby. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed, I think anybody would be hard-pressed to find someone listening to this show who would think that that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's not okay to target someone's family. They didn't get involved in politics, you know, and they shouldn't have to suffer intimidation.
What about a poor, and this has happened in the last week or so, protests outside abortion clinics, as some people call them, or even GP clinics where abortions occur. Is that okay?
No, I don't think that's okay either. Again, I think that's very different to, you know, to political protest outside the Dáil or on the streets or outside a constituency office. I think
it's not a home either, though, is it?
No, but it's a place where people are going to get medical services, and women particularly who are vulnerable, who are in a, who, you know, I think it's unacceptable to be barricading.
So hospitals are off limits as well, are they?
Well, I think let's look at who in fact is being impinged upon there. Who are the people who are the targets of the protest? And with the protests outside, for example, family planning clinics, outside doctor's surgeries, it's going to be the patients who are targeted there and who feel the impact
even
of it.
Even if the protest if the protest is civil enough.
I think it depends. Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. If people are standing peacefully away back and not impeding access,
so then it's okay outside GP clinics.
I think even then, what we need to have is the sort of exclusion zones that we've seen built into the law in the US.
How much of an exclusion zone in that situation?
To be fair to Minister Harris, he has promised legislation on exclusion zones, and I think that strikes the right balance, Cormac. That, in other words, that there is a zone around the clinic, around the surgery, around the hospital, where even that sort of peaceful protest is not permitted because it's obstructive. Obstructive and it's intimidating for those
nobody,
who are seeking
nobody
to
wants
services.
Any individual.
But outside
hang
of that
on,
exclusion zone,
nobody wants any individual, obviously, to be intimidated. But this is the problem. If you have a genuine belief in this country, and if you are a large enough cohort and you want to protest, you keep changing the goalposts. You said, first of all, not outside a home, people accept that. Then you said not outside a place where people get medical services. And then if it's civil, oh yes, that's okay. But then, no, there has to be an exclusionary zone.
Well, but I think it's about striking a fair balance.
The point, Cormac, is in terms of, you know, a hospital or a clinic, we live in a democracy. The people have voted, we've introduced legislation, and the people who are availing of those services need to be able to attend without feeling intimidated, without feeling judged, without feeling, you know, that they're walking past and being examined and being life being made difficult for them. And I understand that people want to protest, but the people they're protesting against are people who are availing of the service and in many cases may be vulnerable.
In your opinion, John Curran, is it okay not to pay charges imposed by government or the state, water charges or taxes or fees, that you think are inherently unfair? Is that okay?
I wouldn't agree with that, no.
Didn't Fianna Fáil say it was okay not to pay water charges at some stage?
Not that I'm aware of. Certainly, I do not support that. The law of the land, as far as I'm concerned, should be upheld. I'm not saying people have to like it, but that certainly is my view on it.
I think there's always a balance. I mean, if you look at our constitutional rights of freedom of association, of assembly, again, they're subject to certain limitations. And of course, again, they have to be fair. We, in a democracy and in a republic, we do need to ensure protection of right to protest, but subject to limitations, subject to ensuring that people can access services free of intimidation and free of obstruction. I do think that's a fair balance, Cormac. I don't think any sort of blanket rule is appropriate, but I do think there should be an understanding about people's homes and about exclusion zones around hospitals.
What is somebody to do if you have respite hours, if you're a carer, you've lost respite hours because of cutbacks, or if your child needs a special needs assistant and you can't get them for love or money, the government won't fund them. Some people say that.
Or if your child has special needs assistants.
I understand that.
Plenty of people have.
People say they need more. Or if your child has a disability and you have nowhere to go and you're on a waiting list. Now, what do you do if you have protested outside your TD's office, if you protest outside the Dáil, if you have rallied and lobbied as a group in society and yet nothing happens? What do you do, Martin Hayden? What type of protest is acceptable for you in that situation?
First of all, my experience in instances like that where people feel they have an entitlement to something that the system has told them they don't, they're not outside my office protesting, they're inside, we're talking about it, we're making representations on their behalf and we're trying to get to the nub of exactly what the issue is and how we see it, and that's how many people work through.
Come on, true elements.
No, but
if your family's living in a hotel room for 5 years and you're listening to the minister say, hang on, we're working on it, what do you do?
There's not been a hotel 5 years. Like, you know, at the end of the day, I think we need to call
children
out.
Children are growing up in hotel rooms.
Yes. But there's a huge churn in that. We're developing the family hubs.
If the progress isn't quick enough, how do they protest?
People can protest, and they do protest in many different ways. But I think when you talk about the protest like last Sunday at Simon Harris's house, you have to call it out for what it is. A lot of this is clickbait for social media. They're recording themselves, they're dying for a bit of confrontation that they can then get and share and put their own little spin on it. And this has happened, colleagues of mine, before the last election, at protests in their office and that. And one element to this in terms of politicians, I don't expect anybody to feel sorry for politicians or anything, but I think it is inherently at the core of our democracy in this country. We would all want good, high-calibre, quality people to enter into public life down the line. We have local elections coming up. As chairman of the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party, I'm dealing with a lot of very good people who are thinking of running for us in the local elections or who have signed up to run for us. And the thing that comes up most often from those people considering getting involved in public service is the impact on their personal life, their impact on the intrusion there on their family, and the impact of the pervasiveness of social media.
Well, Shane Wexford texts to say, they all say the politician's family are not involved, yet these families bang on our doors to ask us to vote for them. That's what he says. Philip Clark says, disconnected arrogance, politicians are legitimate targets at home or anywhere. Now, Drew Harris, the commissioner of the Gardaí, said, Anthony Cunningham, that this is a different kettle of fish, protesting outside somebody's home. If that persists, what happens? What will Gardaí do?
Well, at the moment, if there is a protest and there is a breach of the peace, obviously Gardaí have to invoke their power. But I mean, it has rightfully been condemned, the protesting outside the family home of a politician, where there was an attempt, as Simon Harris has said, to intimidate his family. So, look, there is a balance to be achieved here. The public do have a right to express their opposition to public policy. They do have a right to make their feelings known. But what happens at times, and we've seen this manifesting, is unfortunately this descends into abuse. And members that I represent have been abused in their line of duty and across social media. And that's when it becomes unacceptable.
Drew Harris says, in general, we're here to protect democracy. Part of that is obviously then to protect the institutions and those individuals who are integral to those institutions as well. Is that your belief?
Yeah, well, we have to protect people. We have to protect citizens. If people are being abused or intimidated, then clearly the rule of law is not being upheld in that circumstance.
But he's talking about protecting the institutions and those individuals who are integral to the institutions. So that's not just people. So if there is a conflict here, how does a Gardaí deal with a situation where there's a protest, a legitimate protest, but it somehow infringes an institution of the state or somebody who's integral to that institution? How do you deal with that?
Well, obviously we deal with it in the same way as we deal with any breach of the law. We apply the law accordingly.
What if the protest is legitimate?
Well, most people who are taking part in a protest would feel themselves that it's legitimate. So I suppose
who decides then?
Well, you have to look at all the circumstances in any particular event and see what it is.
And if it's outside an office, that's okay with you, is that it?
Public buildings and public offices of politicians are there because they are public representatives and that's part of what they do. It's where it descends into where a person feels intimidated or the law is broken.
Isn't that subjective,
that guards
though?
Well, it can be subjective, I suppose.
And who do you rely on then as a Garda?
Well, we rely on the person that feels they're being intimidated at the time.
What if they're a snowflake?
Well, I mean, I don't know what a definition of a snowflake actually is. But I mean, you just have to take the circumstances and you have to apply the law accordingly.
But isn't that... Not too many people go into politics or snowflakes.
You'd be surprised. But isn't that the problem here? Because some people would say, look at the role of the Gardaí here. This is the Gardaí taking the nod from those in power.
No, the Gardaí always take the nod from the legislative powers that they actually have. Do you know what I mean? So we have to act according with the law.
But
I mean,
you can't
apply the law as you think that it might be interpreted. You apply the law as it's laid out in legislation.
And to be fair, the Public Order Act, the 1994 Public Order Act, does set out very clearly the circumstances where a breach of the peace may occur. And I should say, many of us in politics, including myself, have been involved in protests, legitimate, peaceful protests for many years. I was on the INMO Nurses March last Saturday, along with many others, along with many of my Labour colleagues, and many other political party representatives, and huge numbers of private citizens and of nurses and INMO members. A peaceful protest made the point, I think, very, very clearly in the pro-choice movement, culminating in the very successful referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment last year. We've protested for many years about public policy in a legitimate way and in a peaceful way, but in a way which ultimately was so effective in seeing that 66.4% majority. So I do think there are many, many ways of making protest and of making peaceful and democratic protest, but it's you know, always subject to ensuring that you don't go over the line and start to intimidate people or to cause harm to others. So I think that's a fairly basic bottom line common sense.
Lorraine says, basic common decency should dictate that anyone is entitled to peace in their own home. It was a sinister and intimidating thing to do. That should not be too difficult to understand. Besides, Mr. Harris, his young wife and baby were also in the house, says Murray. Those who protested outside Simon Harris's house wouldn't have had the courage to put their names on a ballot paper. I am not a supporter of his, but their actions were disgraceful. Politicians deserve their private lives, says one texter. And our Gardaí are to be commended for their prompt action in dealing with the mob at Minister Harris's family home, who engaged in intimidation because they consistently fail at the ballot box. Such action has been rightly condemned by all normal people who value democracy, says Stephen Kieran in Ballinacloash in County Wicklow. And that's just a general flavour of what we're getting, I think, mostly. Anyone, 51551, we're going to ask Antoinette Cunningham of the AGSI and the rest of our panel about the pay deal for nurses and if it's going to blow open the pay pact with the public pay pact. That's after a very quick break.
Email saturday@rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to the programme. I'm with Martin Hayden of Fine Gael, not a snowflake. John Curran of Fianna Fáil, not a snowflake. Ivana Bacic of Labour, also not a snowflake. And Antoinette Cunningham of the AGSI and Jennifer Bray as well. I'll leave them, I don't know. I don't know about them. But you're not a snowflake, Antoinette Cunningham, nor is the AGSI when it comes to asking for more in terms of pay and conditions. We've seen that in the last 2 years or so. You've looked at the INMO and how they've operated over the last couple of weeks and the deal they've got. They're going now to consider, and whether they'll accept or not, we don't know. But surely your members are, you know, knocking on your door and saying, let's go again.
Our members are obviously, and our executive sat this week, Cormac, and looked at the detail that we were provided with in relation to the nurses' proposals from the Labour Court. I was down at the Matter Private on the first day of their strike with Phil Nihay, and there wasn't a nurse on that picket line, I can tell you, that wanted to be there, no more than the guards did what they had to do in 2016. And but I can tell you the deal is very nurse-specific. I suppose the deal that the nurses have, the recommendations they have, is subject to a ballot of their membership, and I believe that ballot is to take place in March. I'm sure that they're going to be going around the country no more than we did at the time in 2016, giving the specific details to their membership throughout whatever workshops or meetings that they propose to have. And so I suppose commentary on it at this point, beyond that, remains to be seen.
So you give me a steadfast guarantee now that the AGSI, no matter what will happen with the INMO deal, will not move for more.
I'll give you no such guarantee, Cormac, because the deal comes in two parts.
There you go. We'll continue to study it.
We'll await the results of the ballot of their membership.
Sure, isn't that trade union code for saying, look, we might, and we're just biding our time?
Not at all. It's certainly not trade union code. The Guards is undergoing, as you know, at this particular time, a significant programme of change. You've seen the recommendations on the Commission of the Future of Policing published in December. You've seen the commentary of the politicians and the Commissioner, Drew Harris, saying he accepts all those recommendations for change. We have to see for us in An Garda Síochána what the implications of that change will be.
Jennifer
and we'll await to see what our work practices will change or not as a result of that.
Oh, isn't there a danger of a free-for-all here?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a motion moved by Ruth Coppinger in the Dáil this week, and I thought the wording was interesting, where she said that a victory for nurses and midwives in their strike will be a victory for all workers, and that this action demonstrates the effectiveness of strike action in seeking pay increases. So in that sentence or two, you're almost striking, I can imagine it's striking fear into the government's kind of the fear about the potential unravelling of their pay agreement. And the worry is that if they give in to the nurses, you'll have to give in to the teachers, the GPs and the rest of the public sector. The other aspect is, the truth of the matter is, we are probably as close now to an election as we ever have been in the last 3 years. Fianna Fáil's Barry Cowan said that if it wasn't for Brexit, we'd be gone to the polls. And what this actually does is that it gives unions more leverage, because I don't know any politician who would want to be on the wrong side of the public sector when their own political fate is about to be decided. And the other issue for government here is the issue of penalties. They didn't penalise the nurses for the action that they took, and I think most people would agree that that was the right thing to do. However, they did penalise the teachers a couple of years ago when they froze their increments. So there is a feeling from people that I've talked to that if they're not going to take those kind of hardline positions with the nurses, they're not going to take it with the other unions. So their hand is weakened in terms of what they can do.
Just on one point Jennifer made there about doesn't know any politician who wants to be on the wrong side of the public service, that's a fair comment, but at the same time there would be a very big price to be paid, let's say, for politicians to be in some way very loose with public purse strings and go into a position where we were having to borrow for pay increases across the board. You could argue politically there'd be as big a price to pay for that as there would the other. Ultimately what we've seen here with the nurses is, while there has been a strike in recent times, this is the culmination of 18 months of negotiations and talks about a new nurses' contract. And the Labour Court recommendations this week, to my mind, are very much a compromise.
But there's new stuff here. There's a new increase here, isn't there?
There is significant elements there that will address the issue of retention. And when I sat down with the Nurses' Strike Committee in Naas Hospital, I very much heard an awful lot about recruitment and retention.
How much is this deal going to cost? Can you put a figure on it?
Obviously, there's phase A and phase B, the contract negotiation element. Has to be worked out over the next 3 weeks, and that's what has to be worked through.
So we don't know.
This is, this, like, financially, it's a long way short of what the nurses demand.
There was talk of 300 million, and they denied that was ever the figure. But you can't even tell me how much it's going to cost.
I've heard you know, I think Pascal Donohue referenced figures during the week.
50 million.
Well, I thought it was less, actually, but 25 or 30, I thought is what I heard.
Is that inclusive or exclusive of Phase B?
I honestly don't know.
Look at what they're saying, Mark. But look what they're saying by text. I'm a public servant, and I can tell you the nurses' deal will lead to pay claims. Based on speaking with people this week, the government gave in to the threats of the Gardaí strike and have now given in to the nurses. This deal is economically incompetent and shows the political establishment has learnt nothing about economic probity. Now, this puts Fianna Fáil in the firing line, because you either hold the line with Fine Gael on public pay, or some say we all go down the Swanee.
Well, in relation to the nurses, I suppose the position is, as the agreement has been reached, we believe and we understand, and both the government and the union have said the same, that it falls within the public service pay agreement. And that's an important point, because we support that public service pay agreement. It is unfortunate, because Martin alluded to the fact that this was something that has been looked at for the last 18 months. It was unfortunate that this, which really revolves around the whole area of recruitment and retention, hadn't been dealt with separately and in advance of this industrial dispute. There was ample opportunity. And the pay agreement, the public service pay agreement, actually had provision in it to allow this type of procedure to be
But in
done.
Terms of a free-for-all, John, are you telling all other unions now who are adopting a wait-and-see policy that it's Fianna Fáil's position that you can back off, there's no other chance of an increase here?
We support the public pay agreement, yes.
So all other unions back off, is that what you're saying?
Unless there are others who may have issues, but they need to address it specifically in terms of the public service pay agreement that we have. That's the basis on which the nurses were dealt with.
So Fianna Fáil is saying, unions, come forward if you want a deal similar to the nurses.
I didn't say that. I said if there is something within the public service pay agreement, and whether it's in the area of retention, which this was largely an issue, a very significant issue, and if you look at the change in the pay scale at the end of the 4 years, it was specifically to try and allow nurses who worked a number of years to stay for that 4 year period.
I'm
making the point that this agreement was done in the context of the public service pay agreement. And that's really, really important.
But why can't the politicians on the panel tell unions, we have a pay agreement similar to what Minister Pascal Donohue said before he changed his stance, it seems. He was talking to Sean O'Rourke last summer. He says, we have a pay agreement. We're in year one of a three-year agreement. We are not going to budge from that. That seems to have changed. Why can't ministers and politicians of all parties hold the line there?
Can I just say one thing? Public service stability agreement.
Can I make a very important point?
Part of the reason that the Gardaí in 2016 felt that they had to go out on a protest was because we do not have access to the IR structures of the state, similar to our other colleagues in the public service. Now, in 2016, the Labour Court recommended that we should get access to the WRC in the Labour Court. 3 years on, we still do not have that access. There are two politicians here, one sitting left of me, one sitting right of me. The guards still do not have that access. That legislation still has not passed through Dáil Éireann, although it is drafted, and that is extremely frustrating. Nurses had a lot of issues around retention and recruitment. They were well flagged at the start of this public service agreement, and they remain unresolved.
And what about private sector workers who don't even have unions?
One second, Cormac. There are unresolved issues around the PSSA, and the sooner the politicians and people in power recognise that when you go into a public sector pay stability agreement, you have to address the outstanding issues. The outstanding issues are lingering. They're lingering for nurses and they're lingering for guards.
There are plenty of outstanding issues in the Gardaí, as you well know.
I do.
Around operations and things being done correctly and above board. Now, why not address within an Gardaí Síochána in terms of just the structure, but also productivity?
Well, I can tell you the capital funding is badly needed for many of the projects that an Gardaí Síochána needs.
It's not just capital funding.
It is an awful lot to do with capital funding. The guards is going through a process of change. A lot of the change process in an Gardaí Síochána needs to be funded by the government. We flagged that as an association many times and we'll continue to flag it.
I think it is important to note here the nurses' agreement does talk about extra responsibility, the change in career path, how after 4 years you move on to the different scale. that does mean increased responsibility, increased productivity in terms of the cost. And I just checked the figures are common because they are known. I just didn't have them in front of me. Mm-hmm. It's 10 to 15 million for this year and 30 to 35 million from next year.
Some people
and
say...
The Nurses Union had always said this would be nurse specific and that there were very specific issues around recruitment and retention leading to understaffing and serious concerns about patient safety in hospitals. And I think that was always at the core of this particular action. And certainly in Labour, we had always said it was possible to resolve this within the terms of the National Pay Agreement, as it has transpired to be the case. It's just a pity the government didn't engage sooner with the
ILO. Well, can I ask Jennifer Bray, when politicians say, look, we need all unions to stick to the pay agreement, even now, will that be taken credibly by unions, do you think?
Absolutely not. I think that they're looking after their members and that's their bottom line. But I do think that there possibly is a little bit of soul searching needed on a wider basis in that the gross inflation and the cost of the public sector was one of the things that led us to the austerity era. And there is a real fear, I think, in government, not that, you know, this is just me reflecting what they are saying, but that if you keep feeding into that bill and adding to that bill and overheating the economy potentially when we're coming into potentially a hard Brexit, is that a road that we want to go down? Now, the merits, the pros and cons for that are far, you know, I'm not an economist, far be from me, but there is a wider issue here, whether we can actually afford it as a country.
And Jennifer's touching at the heart of why the Public Service Stability Agreement is so important. I was first elected in 2011, and one of the most regular clinics I had in my first couple of years as a TD in Kildare was dealing with public servants who had mortgages that they couldn't repay because they had bought their house predicated on the pay rises of the Celtic Tiger, and when the recession came, you know, they had all the problems that came with that. We in Fine Gael are totally committed to ensuring that doesn't happen again.
But you gave yourselves a pay increase. TDs gave themselves a pay increase, didn't they?
The pay restoration that's happened has been targeted at the lowest paid first.
No. TDs earning 90,000 a year got pay increases over in the last... Am I right, Jennifer?
Some TDs went it, others didn't.
We got a percentage of reinstatement of pay, but that reinstatement focused on the lowest paid first, so public servants who are in the 25 to 30,000 bracket are 4% better off than they were.
TDs and senators, and they said, yes, I'll take that. Thank you very much.
So those up to 50,000 in the public service have seen all their money reinstated from pre-crash levels, but those on higher levels haven't.
Okay, Jim in Cork says, your panel is typical of public sector union leadership and politicians who firmly believe that this state is run by and for the guards, the nurses and the teachers. It'll be ordinary private sector workers, people who don't have security of tenure, who don't have gilt-edged pensions, who will have to stump up for these pay increases, says Jim. Can you give a response to Jim very quickly onto that?
Yeah, well, I suppose, look, gilt-edged pensions are over. We know the pension rules changed in 2014. I don't believe there's any such thing as a gilt-edged pension anymore. You must remember that guards and nurses and teachers were subject to very severe FEMPI legislation when financial measures across the public sector were needed and law was introduced. So we did all pay a financial price back in the day.
But Jim will say they didn't lose their jobs, though.
Well, we didn't lose our jobs. We took significant pay cuts, the same as the rest of the country had to do.
Okay, look, we're going to talk about Dublin, dirty old Dublin, and the congestion, one of the worst cities in the world for traffic congestion. We'll ask our panel, how did it come to this, after a quick break.
Text 51551. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
I want you all to talk to me about the survey that was published during the week. We are Dublin, one of the worst cities in the world for time spent sitting in traffic. Now, this was a survey done across 200 cities in 38 countries. Why are we bottom of the league, John Curran?
I think as economic recovery occurred in this country in the last 4 or 5 years, we didn't increase public transport at a rapid enough rate. And the statistics are there to back that up. Journey times have significantly increased. And then we've compounded the problem in certain areas, particularly in the city centre with the Lewis extension, with bus journeys being diverted and so forth. They're actually longer bus journeys. And specifically, when I asked the Minister for Transport, you know, about increasing public transport, the answer was, oh, there'll be 100 new buses this year. And he was exactly right. There were 100 new buses. The problem was 80 were replacement and 20 were additional. So we weren't keeping pace with public transport.
No, it's about TDs like yourself in Dublin who want your party and all parties to focus the jobs on Dublin, to focus the investment on Dublin, to focus the homes on Dublin. There's lopsided investment. Then everybody from Donegal to Kerry has to go to Dublin to get a job. So it's no wonder we have congestion.
We're not a huge city in terms of European cities, and other cities are doing better. So yes, there's an attraction for foreign direct investment and companies to locate, not just in Dublin but in the surrounding counties.
It's unbalanced.
And yes, we have significant investment and we have significant growth in population. But by comparison to European cities, we should be able to do significantly better on public transport than we are.
At least Antoinette Cunningham can go down the bus lanes, I suppose. Being in the AGSI, you won't be stopped.
One thing I can't do is go down the bus lanes, let me assure you that. I travel by public transport myself to work. I live in Limerick, I work in Dublin, so it's trains, buses and Lewis's for me, same as lots of other people. I suppose, look, sectors like digital IT and those kind of sectors are driving movement inwards into the city centre, and we'd be far better if we had a programme that of rural economic development, and let's drive it outwards and not inwards.
You don't believe we have?
Well, I think there's more could be done to create a balance. Cities will always suffer what cities do, and a part of that is congestion into cities. We've seen the City of London in recent years and what they had to do. But I suppose, look, there's always room for more rural investment.
But look at poor Martin Hayden there. He's a TD for Kildare. Now, if he stood up at his parliamentary party meeting and says, look, I want more investment outside of Dublin, he'd be laughed out of it, because electorally, all the parties want to focus their attention on Dublin. Isn't that right?
That's not the case at all. So we have Minister Heather Humphreys, my colleague, is going around the country at present with the enterprise, the regional enterprise plans, and we have seen across the regions in every area of Ireland, employment has increased. We've seen very significant investment in recent years by government through Project Ireland 2040 with very ambitious plans. Only this week, Minister Michael Ring announced another $62 million under Rural Regeneration Scheme, as well as Owen Murphy's Urban Regeneration Scheme that has €2 billion into it. And really what we're looking to do...
Some of those schemes are failing badly though, aren't they? Urban regeneration is not...
You can ask the people of Italia that who got $2.7 million last Thursday. They don't feel that. Not at all.
Why is it congestion starting in Maynooth and leaks up on the N4, for example, from 7 o'clock in
but
the morning?
But the whole approach of our national development plan here is to make sure that Kildare, Wicklow, Meath, you know, don't become a suburb of Dublin. And like, I have too many constituents both in South Kildare and in Port Arlington who are commuting that horrendous commute every day. And what we want to make sure is that we develop good quality jobs in the regions so that people don't have that. You can't stop multinationals who come to you and say, we want to be in Dublin.
Focus on Dublin, Jennifer. Isn't that what they say in all the political parties?
I'm not sure about that. But look, there's definitely majority focus on Dublin. Let's be honest. I mean, we've got a parliament based in Dublin. That's where all the action happens.
Most seats are in Dublin, is that it?
Well, yeah, exactly. To be fair, it is where the focus is. But, you know, if we're going to talk about congestion and issues like that in Dublin, we're going to talk about public transport, we also need to talk about like cycling. I'm a cyclist. I cycle into work whenever I can. I am dicing with death every time I get on that bike, you know, and that's a fact. There are other issues that need to be addressed, you know, need to make kind of Dublin more and other cities more cycle friendly, and also, you know, cyclists who break red lights, etc. They also
What about a congestion charge then, like they have in London?
I'm not sure that would really work here, to be honest. I mean, London is different boroughs, etc. I don't really know enough about it, to be totally honest.
Why not, Ivana?
I think there's a lot more we could do before we even look at congestion charges. Like Jennifer, I cycle everywhere in Dublin. I think we should be doing far more. If there is this focus on Dublin you speak of, Cormac, we're certainly not seeing it in terms of investment in greater greening of Dublin, greater emphasis on sustainability and environmentally friendly ways of moving around the city. So I cycled here today. The road surfaces are terrible for cyclists. Mm. City centre is a nightmare for cyclists currently because of so little thought that has been given to cyclists and to provision for cyclists on roads. And this is a huge issue. Even in Leinster House, I've been campaigning for years to try and get better bicycle parking facilities. And it's just always this emphasis on the car, always, throughout our transport policy.
But you're talking about bicycles. What about a bullet train to Tullamore? And that half the people who can't afford Dublin live in Tullamore.
It is about more investment in public transport and cycling and infrastructure for transport
which
that is not reliant on private cars. The current Minister for Transport has been so disappointing on this. As a Dublin-based minister, he should be focusing on ensuring people don't have to use their car.
But we are seeing the extension of the DART. We are seeing the Phoenix Park Tunnel, you know, a range of road projects as well. But, like, you know, we are seeing
Dublin cycling market saying there's no safe to enter Phoenix Park.
The crux of the problem is, and the government are right, they have plans in terms of DART and Lewis extensions and Metro and whatever. But you need in parallel with that to have some short-term measures. And the only short-term solution is significant increase capacity in Dublin bus. And they need to be accompanied by Park and Ride. And we need to have a very clear vision that for the next 5 years, none of those major infrastructure projects that the government are planning will have come on stream.
Doesn't the problem start in Martin's neck of the woods? People from Kildare and Meath and Westmeath and Offaly trying to get into Dublin in the morning.
That's a very good point. If you're coming from Kildare and you get as far as the Putchin Still on the Naas Road, there should be Park and Ride facilities at that location. The same on the N4 when you get as far as Leakslip or the Spa Hotel and all the routes in. There should be park and rides, and they might only be for a 5 year period, but we need to take some short term measures for the next 5 years while some of these capital projects that are being planned, and it may take longer than that to deliver, but we need to, and the current minister is not looking like that.
Buses don't turn up on time, and when they turn up late you're told by the driver, don't take the bus if you want to be somewhere on time, says one texter. Anyway, look, I'm all glad you got time, because it took Martin Hayden and John Curran 15 hours to get in from West Dublin and Kildare today. Martin Hayden of Fine Gael, John Curran of Fianna Fáil, Ivana Bacic of Labour, Antoine Cunningham of the AGSI, and Jennifer Bray, who cycled here from the Irish Times. Would you expect anything less of the Irish Times? No, you would not. That's all. Until 1 o'clock next Saturday, Sloan.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Tom Donnelly. Research was by A.B. Philbin-Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Mark McGrath was on sound.